TE Connectivity designs and develops precise products and solutions that connect and protect the flow of power and data to overcome challenges in industrial robotics. TE connectors, sensors, EMI filters, passive components, and relays help ensure the enormous quantities of data points from the robots and their manufacturing environment are gathered and routed at the highest possible speeds. With its innovative technology, experience, and creativity, you'll find it easy to achieve higher productivity and efficiency with better and reliable connectivity. Connect with TE Connectivity at TE.com to learn more. Welcome to episode 60, Mike, of the Robot Report podcast, which brings conversations with robotics innovators straight to you. I'm Steve Curro, editorial director of the Robot Report. Thanks, as always, folks, for tuning in. If this is your first time joining us, thank you. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, SoundCloud. You get the idea. Anywhere you get your podcast, please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. Joined as always by the editor of our robotics group, Mr. Mike Oitzman, fresh off his trip to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to check out the Indy Autonomous Challenge. How you doing, man?
Well, Steve, well, you know, I'm a little bit tired of being on planes, but I tell you what, this was an incredible, historic event at Indy Motor Speedway this last weekend, especially for race fans and technology fans. So I had a great time.
You couldn't hail one of those traveling, what, 136 mile an hour, average speed of the winner, which we'll get into later on in the show. But you couldn't hail one of those things back to your home.
No, I couldn't. Not yet. And you know, I had a lot of emotions about going to this event. You know, first of all, as a motorsports fan, I was in awe of being at the Indy Motor Speedway for the first time. And not only that, having a media pass, which gave me unfettered access to every part of the track, something you wouldn't get on a normal race day.
I don't think I knew you were a motorsports fan. Maybe I did.
Yeah. Indy. Yeah. And F1, follow F1 pretty closely. So, which also was a big race yesterday, Sunday, the US Grand Prix happened as well in Austin. So I'll tell you what, so, you know, and just to tell you about this event, so it was interesting. During breakfast at the hotel lobby, I was, you know, sitting down discussing the plan for the day with Brad and Garrett, our WTWH videographers, who I brought with us. And we've got a ton of video, which we're trying to edit together here. So it's going to be a few more things that come out in the next couple of weeks from the event. But we had this couple at the table next to us. They interrupted us and said, "Hey, are you guys going to this autonomous race at Indy?" And we're like, "Yeah." And it turns out that they had driven all the way from Michigan just to see this race. And this guy says he's come to, you know, every Indy 500 since 1961. So he was an older gentleman, and he was so fascinated about what these cars were going to be able to do. So and this was a big deal for race car fans.
Were there any pro racers there? Do you know?
There weren't any pro racers that I ran into. If they were there, they were sort of keeping a low profile. I certainly can't recognize everybody with their helmet off.
No Michael Schumacher
and there wasn't anybody that they made a big deal about. But I think there was certainly some race car professionals who were helping to advise the team. So they certainly had that, giving them, you know, ideas about, you know, whether, how to race and, you know, whether the track was ready and how to push the parameters. So, you know, and the other big thing, you know, that I'm a high school robotics mentor, and, you know, this whole thing had the big vibe of a robotics competition. So, you know, we were able to tour the team garages before the competition, meet and interview several of the team members. And, you know, it's just like, you know, a high school robotics event on steroids, you know, and that became infectious. And in fact, the Indiana governor made a big deal about the fact they invited more than 350 STEM students from around the state to the event. Awesome. So it was definitely inspirational for.
I know you were a little worried, though. I think I talked to you. Did I talk to you Saturday morning? It was either Friday night or Saturday morning. You and I talked, and you weren't sure the race was even going to happen.
That's right. Yeah, we got out there on Thursday night, and, you know, we wanted to get the racetrack, get a bunch of interviews in, get some B-roll of the cars running. But Friday got rained out, so it rained pretty hard on Friday, and A lot of folks were concerned about whether we were even going to have the race on Saturday. So, but as it turned out, the sun came out, you know, between the clouds on Saturday, dried up the track and warmed it up enough so that we were able to run the event on Saturday. And, you know, when they put the first car on the track, you heard the motor start up. And, you know, the tracks, the stands were mostly empty. I mean, there was a couple thousand people there and we put them all on the pit side of the racetrack. So you're looking across, all the rest of the stands are empty. But when those cars came by, it echoed like crazy because there was nothing to dampen the sound. So
I'm not a racing fan. I've obviously seen some NASCAR races in my time, but for somebody like me, you always like to see, or maybe that's the wrong way to say it, but the crashes are kind of what grabs your attention. Were there crashes? I mean, were there, I saw some spinouts that happened. Did any of these cars get major damage? Or?
There were, you know, there were nine teams, actually eight made it to Saturday. So there were nine teams and one team didn't make it to Saturday. So there were eight teams that were going to put cars on the track, and out of the eight teams, there were two major accidents that destroyed the front ends of two cars. Oh, yeah. So, it was really hard to watch that happen, even though, you know, there wasn't a human inside the car. You know, your hearts went up for the teams, you know, as those accidents happened. So both of them put their cars into the wall, unfortunately. And then there was one team that spun out, and actually I've got video of it that I've posted on some of my social media. The team from Hawaii and UC San Diego actually followed the wrong road at the end of turn one, which would be the road course, and then it spun out on the grass. It didn't damage the car, but the vehicle got confused and at speed and wasn't able to recover. And from what I heard walking through the pits is that most all of those accidents were caused by GPS issues, not from the actual algorithms driving the car. So that's unfortunate as well, but it's a learning experience, right?
GPS, do you know any more on that? Is it weather related? Was the GPS not working well, or just in general, GPS wasn't accurate enough? Do you have any more info
about that? Don't have any more detail. And it's worth following up with those teams to learn a little bit more. But yeah, I'd heard they'd been experiencing some GPS issues all week. Certainly at slower speeds, but with everybody pushing it, you know, when you lose a GPS for a few milliseconds or so, and it's just one of the sensor feedback elements that help them understand, you know, where the car was. And one of the things that we'll post here before the end of the week is an interview with AD Link's CTO, Joe Speed. Joe will take you through the car and talk about all the technology that's there, and including the GPS, that each of these vehicles had four GPS receivers on it, one on the left and the right and one in four aft. So for a total of four, they actually had very accurate information coming back from the GPS sensors about whether the vehicle was sliding or spinning or didn't have traction or wasn't where it's supposed to be. So you could imagine, you know, if the algorithms didn't have that input, how that could wreak havoc on, you know, the control of the vehicle at speed.
And the vehicles were virtually identical, right? They had the same chassis. They had all the same components. Is that right? And it really came down to the software and the algorithms,
right,
that they were able to come up with themselves.
The cars were 100% identical. So this wasn't a competition about vehicle design or even, you know, crafting the setup of the vehicles. The race engineers had the identical setup for all the vehicles. So if they, you know, put more downforce on one car, they put it on all the cars. So they all had the similar setup. This was really a race about software. Yeah. And so in a few minutes, once we get through the news, Steve, we're going to hear from the team lead for the winning team. And he's going to talk us through how they made decisions on race day and, you know, pulled this whole thing together to actually have a winning event on Saturday.
Yeah, Alex Wisniewski, hopefully I'm pronouncing that right, but the team lead from the Technical University of Munich. So some great insight about the technical challenges involved, right, of going driving an autonomous race car at, what was the average speed, 136 miles an hour.
Right, yep.
Incredibly fast. There's a lot of logistical challenges, too, that the winning team hails from Munich. So he gets into, you know, living in an apartment, right, near the motor speedway for the last 4 months, and just some of the challenges with COVID and their simulation team back in Germany. So really interesting discussion that we'll get to here in a few minutes. But first, Mike, let's take a look at the news from the last week. And we have you covered, folks, with the best news and analysis of the global robotics industry with our network of robotics sites. You can check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, Mobile Robot Guide, and Collaborative Robotics Trends. First news item here, Mike, an interesting little nugget that came from ABB's third quarter financial results. We now know how much ABB paid to acquire ASTI Mobile Robotics. This took place back in July 2021, and ABB spent $190 million, including $7 million in cash, to acquire the Spanish developer of autonomous mobile robots. I think we have Ash Sharma on a recent podcast, and we were trying to guess how much the acquisition was for, weren't we? We'll have to go back and
somewhere in that neighborhood. But yeah, $190 million, that's a decent price.
Yeah, is it a bargain? Is it not a bargain? I don't know. If you look at some of the other recent acquisitions, AMR acquisitions, we don't know the price that Locus paid to acquire Waypoint last month, September. We do know Zebra Technologies paid $290 million for Fetch Robotics in July. Of course, Shopify paid almost, what was it, $450 million to acquire Six River Systems a couple of years ago. So ABB, $190 million to acquire ASTI Mobile Robotics. They've been around for a while. They're currently selling, they're on pace to generate $50 million in revenue this year, growing at a 30% clip, which is pretty good. They're one of four AMR companies to be acquired since May of this year. We just ran through some of the other ones. Next Shift Robotics was also acquired in May. You know, we had Sami Atiya, the CEO of ABB Robotics, on the podcast back when this acquisition happened. So we'll make sure to link to that episode in the show notes as well. But basically, and this is the question that I always ask when these acquisitions take place, you know, Sami said more of ABB's customers began asking about mobile robotics solutions, right? They had the industrial arms or the collaborative arms from ABB. They were looking to get some more mobile solutions added to the mix as well. And, you know, ABB really didn't have that. Right. So according to Sami, he said this on the podcast, buying ASTI rather than developing its own solutions gave ABB a quick and respected way to diversify its robotics portfolio and to provide more value to existing and new customers, which I certainly agree with. At this point in time, it was quicker for ABB to acquire an AMR company rather than build out its own technology. But I always go back to, you know, and he said even 5 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, developing an autonomous mobile robot, it was too early as far as scaling a business like that goes. But, you know, $190 million is just still a lot of money. Maybe it's not a lot of money for ABB. And I know the shareholders had to approve of this acquisition. But I always just go back to, you know, if they were somehow able to co-develop some AMRs alongside with growing their cobot business and industrial robot arm business, it would have been a lot less than $190 million to get something like that going.
Well, you know, I think the other thing we've heard from both of these, a couple of these recent stories, you know, ABB and ASTI had been working together at multiple customers for a couple of years. So they were familiar with each other. They're both European companies. So that made, you know, probably good sense for both of those organizations to come together and expand their reach now globally. And same thing for Zebra and, you know, Fetch, right? They had been working together for a couple of years, as we learned from Melanie, you know, prior to the acquisition. And, you know, again, another partnership that grew to an acquisition that probably made good sense just across the board for the broader portfolio.
Yep. So again, $190 million ABB paid to acquire ASTI Mobile Robotics. We have more about that on therobotreport.com as well. We link to the complete report of ABB's third quarter financial results if you want to check that out as well. So just go to the robotreport.com. Up next here, Mike, Fabric in another $100 million plus round, actually $200 million in Series C funding for micro fulfillment startup Fabric today.
Right. Yeah. When these guys are what a startup story that it's really just been the last couple of years, 3 years really, that we've been covering, watching them grow quickly now to a Series C funding round. And again, you know, delivering a solution in a robots as a service business model we know is capital intensive. So, you know, $200 million for, you know, the amount of systems that they have to build to keep up with their business probably is right on pace, I would say. And, you know, they're chasing the same market that other competitors we've covered, such as AutoStore, Ocado, you know, Adabotics, and now Urbex. So, you know, this is a hot market for the automated storage and retrieval and micro fulfillment marketing, and, you know, kudos to Fabric for, you know, closing this round.
Yeah. And if people listening to this haven't heard of Fabric, they were previously known as Common Sense Robotics. So maybe, mm-hmm. you know, that name as well. But we'll have more details on their $200 million raise later on today as well. Sticking with logistics robotics news, Mike, my favorite startup of the year. I think we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, right? I wish I could say I saw this coming, but I obviously did not. Hi Robotics unveiled today 3 new products at CeMAT, a large logistics trade show in Asia.
Right, and this is a story that will be on both sites today as well. But you know, they brought out what they're calling the A3 forklifting robot. They've got another flexible width robot, which is designated as the A42FW. And then they have another version of their A42T telescopic robot. And, you know, again, I think that's one of the things you talked about with their, you know, deep storage, both heights and depth of storage on yep. shelves. So that new telescopic robot can reach up to 10 meters. So that's, you know, quite high in the warehouse.
We got some better marketing over there. Those product names just rolled.
It's a mouthful, isn't it? Right?
Man. But yeah, again, I think I wrote a story about their funding round a couple of weeks ago. And their autonomous case handling robots is what they call them. I can reach up to high shelves. This is like the third or fourth iteration of a product like that I've seen in just the last month or so. So mm-hmm. obviously there's something there. It's not just Hi Robotics. There's other companies doing similar work there, but something to keep an eye on. You know, right. how do those types of systems compare to an AutoStore, an Ocado, and Adabotics? Obviously much more expensive systems to install into a newer facility, but something to keep an eye on at Hi Robotics. A couple of final quick news items here, Mike. After taking a short vacation, the NASA Perseverance rover back to work, posted some new pictures on Twitter yesterday. Actually, I think it was probably late last night. Just stunning images. These never get old to me. I don't know if you've seen them yet, but just a couple pictures of the rover hanging around a couple of different rock formations. They actually also posted to the, I didn't know they did this, but a picture of the week where the public can vote on the picture of the week. And there just is a pretty big rock that is sitting in front of the rover in another picture. So just always great to see these pictures in the rover back to work. And then finally, just a quick update. We talked on Friday, I think the last episode aired, about SoftBank reportedly negotiating the sale of SoftBank Robotics Europe to German distributor United Robotics Group. Now, SoftBank Robotics Europe, formerly Aldebaran, they're responsible for creating the Now and the Pepper robots. United, just at the beginning of October, became the main distributor for both of those robots throughout all of Europe. And again, I think I mentioned this a little bit last week, that we had reached out to both SoftBank Robotics Europe and United Robotics Group for comment on this report, which was first reported by Reuters, just looking to get confirmation or any additional information that they might be willing to share. I've heard back from both companies. I actually just heard from United Robotics Group prior to recording this podcast. And again, this is probably a little bit too inside of baseball, but I think I try to be careful with words, and I read into the way people say things perhaps a little bit too closely sometimes. But again, here's what a source from SoftBank Robotics Europe said to me. And again, I've had conversations with this person. This person's been willing to share things with me in the past. This person wrote via email, quote, "Sorry for the late reply. Very busy today. No comment from my side." And then I got a statement from a communications rep at United who said to me, quote, "I can't comment on that. Maybe I'm misreading this." I responded to the SoftBank source and I said, okay, well, you know, basically with what you just said, I'm reading into that as something is happening here, right? And he didn't reply. There was no reply to that message that I wrote back. But these aren't denials to me, right? These aren't categorical denials that no discussions are taking place, right? You often see a company say, oh, we're not doing that. We're committed to this, blah, blah, blah. You know, SoftBank Robotics Europe has said several times over the last couple of months that it's committed to Pepper and the, mm-hmm. and the business of Pepper, right? So again, these are not categorical denials. You know, United could easily have said, you know, we're always looking to grow our, you know, robotics portfolio that we distribute throughout Europe, you know, blah, 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 blah. There's, it's very easy to come up with a company statement.
Right.
So to me, and again, I could be 100% wrong here. I don't think I am. But I think these are folks who know something is happening. They're involved in it. And they just don't want to be the one to let the cat out of the bag if somehow, you know, it was to get back to them. But
well, it's definitely one we're going to continue to follow.
Yeah, we'll definitely continue to follow it. I've reached out to some other folks that I know at SoftBank Robotics Europe who have previously been tied into there to try to find out some more information. But again, we'll keep you posted as we always do. We have the best news and analysis of the global robotics industry with our network of robotics sites. You can check us out at The Robot Report, Robotics Business Review, Mobile Robot Guide, and Collaborative Robotics Trends.
Before we get to today's interview, Mike, it's time now for the technology tip of the week brought to you by TE Connectivity. This week's tip explains how sensors and sensor infrastructure are transforming how robots operate in digital factories. Efficient digital factories are optimizing human-robot interactions. The robots are helping humans more easily perform cumbersome and time-consuming tasks. But as everybody listening to this podcast knows, using robots comes with many challenges, particularly around manufacturing processes that require accuracy and efficiency. These challenges are creating a greater need for sensor-equipped robots, robots that can quickly perform manufacturing tasks while also ensuring the safety of the humans who are working nearby. And this is where the sensors come into play, right? Controlling a robot's movements with sensors attached to and built into the robot really play a crucial role here. This provides the flexibility needed to accommodate variances in human activity. The sensors help ensure that robots can effectively detect the exact position of a manufactured object, which in turn informs the performance of the robot. Now, when creating this type of connection and detection system for robots, the goal is finding opportunities to improve the precision of the process and reduce processing time. Let's take a robotic gripper, for example. This could mean using a connectivity solution that allows the gripper to continuously turn in one direction. This also eliminates inefficient processes, such as having to stop the operation after each cycle so the gripper can turn back to its original starting position. The engineering challenge is configuring a robot that not only performs the necessary steps without failure and within the fast-paced and harsh environment of a modern factory, but also delivering reliable, continuous connectivity and offering high resistance to the daily wear and tear of production. That's why more robot tools like grippers are becoming electrically operated as opposed to the more conventional pneumatic systems. And digital factories are requiring greater levels of power to effectively operate these electric grippers. So managing the flow of power here is really key. And engineers on TE Connectivity's advanced technology team have developed a connection system that makes it possible to transfer energy and data over an air gap of several millimeters. These innovations in connector and sensor technology are helping industrial robots operate more reliably in any production environment, regardless of the extreme conditions that the production processes generate. So if you want to learn more about how TE Connectivity can help you, visit TE.com to learn more.
All right, Steve. Well, today on the podcast, we are excited to welcome Alex Wisniewski. He's the team lead for the Technical University of Munich, and they were the winning team on Saturday at the 2021 Indianapolis or Indy Autonomous Challenge. So, Alex, hey, thanks for joining us today and welcome to the podcast. On behalf of the Robot Report and the Mobile Robot Guide, congratulations to you and your team for winning the IAC 2021 inaugural race event at Indy Motor Speedway. And you guys had the fastest two-lap average speed of 135.944 miles per hour.
All right, yeah. Hello also from my side. Hi, Mike. Hi, Steve. Thanks for inviting me. So my name is Alexander Wisniewski, and I'm working with the Technical University of Munich as the leader of the TUM Autonomous Motorsports team. I'm a fourth-year PhD student there at the Chair of Automotive Technology and the Chair of Automatic Control, and my research is focused around autonomous vehicles, obviously. So last Saturday was a pretty important day for our team. We managed to secure first place in this international competition, which was a great achievement and paid off all the hard work we put into this topic in the past year. So I'm really proud of what the team achieved. Looking back to Saturday, I think probably the most memorable experience was just like the 3 days, like really the Thursday, Friday, Saturday seen together as the 3 days where we for the first time pushed the limits of those vehicles. Then had a rain day on Friday, and obviously that put us in a position where we had to make quite risky choices about how fast the vehicle can go, and also some difficult setup choices, which had to be made purely on simulation. And given the short amount of time we had at the speedway in general, that was just a tough experience. But I think that was the same for all the teams, so we've all been in the same boat, and that's probably also part of this competition.
Right. And what I enjoyed watching you guys, all of you guys compete was that there was really some great competition. And it seems that Polymove was probably your closest competitor until they made a fatal mistake on their final lap. You guys went first in that last round, and then you had to wait. So how nervous were you guys once you finished your final run? You wish you had maybe pushed it a little harder, or were you satisfied once you guys had finished your final run?
Yeah, so I think the finals with Polymove and Euro Racing have just been, all three teams have shown great performance during testing. So it was pretty obvious that, that's going to be tough. And with obviously Polymove going first, us going second and Euro Racing going third, that gave us at least, let's say, a reasonable spot. But, if you're not the last in that set, you really have to look on what yourself can do and what you feel comfortable with, what your car, what your setup can do. Because basically, if we would only have been looking at Polymove, that would have put Euro Racing in a position where they could have just, reacted to what we did.
Yeah.
And so we tried to, after those setup changes on Friday, we upped the speeds a lot from the first run, because the first run in the semifinals looked pretty good. Mm-hmm. And then we made the call of what was possible. Just the time frame on Saturday was crazy. It was starting to rain a little. So, it was all the time that was up in the air. If there's some small raindrops are coming down, the temperatures were going down. And that was just super hard to decide on how much risk you want to take and how much risk is necessary to win the competition.
This sounds like any normal race team, even with a human driver, everybody's making decisions. Do you come in? Do you change tires? Which tires do you play on? Right? How fast do you push it? All those decisions come together, even in this case, and you had so many other parameters to play around.
Yeah, it's pretty much, sometimes it feels like we are the race engineers for that software driver. So, you're like working out with the software what's the best strategy. Obviously, it's hard for the software to tell you what it feels, but it gives you a lot of data after the run. So, that's pretty similar in the way like human drivers work with their race teams. to maximize the performance of the car. And I think it's a great achievement that we actually got to the point where multiple teams were in the position to, like, you know, think about those decisions, which are classical racing car things or race car decisions, because that proves that we haven't been far away from what those cars could have been doing. Obviously, there's more speed to gain, but I think it has to be kept in mind that we've been running late October at around 12 degrees Celsius. I don't know how many Fahrenheit that are, but it was pretty cold. It was close to the minimum operating temperatures of the tires. So I think, yeah, giving all those boundary conditions, we pushed the cars really hard.
How did you guys put your team together? And I know you guys have experience from Robo Race in the past. Is it the same team that competed in Robo Race, or how did you guys put together this team for the Indy Autonomous Challenge?
So our team started off with around four team members in late 2017 when we worked with the company Robo Race and did those demonstration runs and fast laps and first races with them. That grew up pretty quickly to seven, all of these seven being PhD students. And then over time, just the team grew because it's an interesting topic. It's pushing the edge of technology. And so we got a little more people on the team. And then suddenly when COVID hit, we had to make that call whether we want to focus on the Robo Race competition or on the Indy Autonomous Challenge. And as you all know, that choice has been the Indy Autonomous Challenge in the end. Sure. And that put us in a position where we could have where we work with 15 PhDs on this topic and 30 to 40 undergraduate and graduate students, which were with us during their thesis project. So it was actually a pretty, pretty big team.
What about some of the logistical challenges leading up to this? Obviously, you guys are from Germany. You said before we started recording this interview that you've been in the US for 4 months, living in an apartment and renting cars and returning them. Just what's that experience been like, and how much of a challenge was that?
So obviously the original plan was that people will go back and forth, but that wasn't possible because of COVID. And also I felt like given all the collaboration we had with the other teams, it was really the right decision to move like a part of the team to really build up a US base here. So we had four people here since late June until the competition. And maybe there were basically two challenges there. The first really was to set up everything here because sometimes you don't have access to all the resources, which probably local teams have access to. Mm-hmm. It's like getting the visas and everything it wasn't super hard, but it gave us additional work where we actually wanted to focus on developing race car software. But we were pretty grateful that ESN, but also Purdue University, all of them really did a great job in helping us with these things and supporting us in the best way they possibly can. And then the second thing really was to manage the work together with the team back in Germany. So this is probably a point where COVID was something we could learn from. Mm-hmm. So being through this work from home phase already since early 2020, that's something where we really practiced those workflows, how that could work out. So we took something from this work from home period. But the big challenge there still was the time difference because that was 6 hours. But I think we managed pretty good. It also has some advantages because if we came back from testing, we could send a bunch of emails with the data we got and the learnings. And then the team back in Germany could work on that while we have been sleeping here.
Were they running simulations back in Germany? Because I know simulation was a big part of this whole competition.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, so we have a big simulation setup in Germany, and they've been doing this, but they also have been really, working on improving the code stuff and then testing it thoroughly before we run it here on the real car. So obviously we have been more involved with the actual operations of the car, and them have been more involved with the preparations of the testing.
So you mentioned that you had experience with Robo Race in the past, and can you think that puts you in a unique place here to maybe tell us a little bit about the difference between the Robo Race setup and experience compared to what happened at the Indy Autonomous Challenge. So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
So I think the major difference between Robo Race and the Indy Autonomous Challenge was the choice of the course. So Robo Race is running road course like circuits. Especially back in the days, they had all the cars in Europe, and we have been running on a variety of road courses in Europe. And here at the Indy Autonomous Challenge, it was an oval that poses totally different challenges in terms of vehicle dynamics, software development. It's just different. So at the Speedway, it's much more about lateral control than it is about longitudinal control. So managing your steering, getting the right point on where to steer, finding the right line in terms of when you enter the turn and how you enter the turn, that was much more important than it was in Robo Race. On the other side, stuff like braking control, for example, it was in Robo Race much more important than it has been here. So on a road course, probably braking points are the most important thing. That doesn't really matter on an oval because you don't want to break anyway.
Right. So it's about finding the line and staying on the line at the Indy Motor Speedway, and then just being consistent in how you ride around. And I think that even the human drivers would say the same thing, right? It's about being consistent. Yeah. And I would imagine that an autonomous driver has a little bit of an advantage there. In terms of being able to apply that. And it seems to me, watching you guys run, that you pretty much followed a pretty similar line each lap. So I noticed that, and obviously you guys were paying attention to it.
Yeah, that's true. But still bringing in consistency, or usually people think, or there is this impression that things on a computer are always repeatable. But given the setup we have been running was like a really complex multi-processing architecture, so running a variety of different software components in parallel to like max out the capacity of that computer. And these systems are like inherently non-deterministic, so actually I don't know how much I should get deep into the weeds about that here, but just to say this, we have been seeing situations in simulation where you could run 10 laps and on the 11th lap, there's something like going on the operating system, which he doesn't want to go on. And then it kicks in and it like prevents you from actually completing that lap. So it's still a challenge to make these drivers run so consistently. It's maybe easier than for humans, but It isn't as easy as you usually think when you think about computers.
Right.
Alex, I'm fascinated by autonomous vehicles in general. One of the areas of the robotics industry I love to follow is robo-taxis and the developments that are happening there. Two of the leading companies in the U.S. anyway are Cruise and Waymo. And they recently, I'm not sure you know this, they recently were approved by the California Department of Motor Vehicles to give public citizens rides in their robo-taxis in California in certain neighborhoods at certain times of the day, and they're limited to certain speeds. So Cruise's autonomous vehicles are limited to operating at 30 miles an hour. Waymo's vehicles are limited to operating at 60 miles an hour. Contrast that with what you guys did over the weekend at the Indy Autonomous Challenge. You averaged 136 miles an hour. It's a lot, obviously a lot faster than some of those robo-taxis on public roads. And I get the closed course and the differences there. But what are some of the challenges of driving an autonomous vehicle at 136 miles an hour? Is it a sensor challenge? Is it a computing challenge? Just talk about some of the challenges going that fast.
The big challenge over all computational or overall software components is speed in the sense that computational speed or computational that you really need the results fast. So that's something which is pretty similar to human drivers. Mm-hmm. So a good driver has good reaction times, and minimizing that time from the time instance when a sensor picks up some data to actually react on that with a steering command is really crucial. So it has been often said that, you know, this is a thing of milliseconds, but if you actually look at real autonomous driving where you have to do object detection, you have to understand what the objects want to do, you have to readjust your plan, you have to actually calculate steering, throttle, and brake values from that. That can easily take several hundreds of milliseconds, depending on how your system is designed, depending on what kind of algorithms you choose. And bringing down that time is crucial to drive the speeds we have been driving at, especially if we look forward when we want to go to bring more than one car on the track at the same time. Because if you see or if you want to race head to head, you have to react on what other cars are doing.
Mm-hmm.
So minimizing that reaction time is probably, let's say, the overarching theme where we have to work on. And even with like today's computers, and there is something to be improved. And yeah, it is not only about pure computation time. It's about synchronizing the timings of the sensors, for example, that like all the sensors give you accurate timestamps of the data with like millisecond accuracy, because you have basically like 10 different small computers in there. Each of these sensors has a small microchip on there, which is like processing the data. You have to synchronize the clocks of all of them, and all these timing things are probably the most challenging thing. Despite all the vehicle dynamics things and everything which come in there. But yeah, and I think that's something where we can learn something from the racetrack and bring it to like real world applications. Because obviously, you know, you don't want your Waymo cruise vehicle, whatever, to race you to where you are. But I think everyone wants those vehicles to be super safe in case of a sudden brake maneuver because there's an accident in front of you. So those learnings, you know, at the racetrack, you have those situations every turn, every corner. So you're really forced to work on them. And that's something which we can take to bring, or I think the research community can bring to the table when it comes to make autonomous driving reality.
What can you tell us? What can you share about the sensor stack that was used? You know, I'm assuming off the shelf type sensors, but what can you tell us about the computational sensor setup that you guys had in order to ensure that fast reaction time?
So we've been using four different main sensor modalities, which is GPS as a like general localization source. Then there is LiDAR, radar, and camera for object detection.
Mm-hmm.
So using those three different sensor modalities, like each of them has like different strengths. Basically, for example, the radar is pretty good at like long range detection and it actually gives you speed measurements of the vehicles in front of you. Then you have LiDAR, which can give you super precise distance measurements. And then there's the camera, which allows you to actually understand like different styles of objects, but it's harder to get like a true distance measurement from a 2D image because it's just that information isn't there. So what you usually do then is like you correlate that with information you have previously. Like we as humans, like we have a sense of how big that object is, and then you get an understanding of how far away that is. So, and you know, combining those three strengths allows you to build a pretty solid perception stack. But again, here's the big challenge to synchronize all those informations. All these sensors run at different update rates, at different time instances and everything. And so running at, you know, at the speed where we run, a car moves more than half a meter in 10 milliseconds.
Hmm.
So if you can't get timing accuracy below 10 milliseconds, you already have half a meter of uncertainty just because of timing inaccuracies. And 10 and doing something precisely up to the order of 10 milliseconds is probably not even easy. So I think it's really important to understand that. So that has been the speeds where we were running at. I think the speeds where we want to run at, so close to 180, 200 miles, we are close to 1 meter in 10 milliseconds. And that's just, yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
Crazy.
Wow. That is crazy. And it was fascinating to watch. You know, I watched the live stream, checked out some of the live coverage that was going on social media. So really fascinating to watch. I do have to ask you though, Alex, when do you think we'll see autonomous races with multiple autonomous race cars on the track at the same time? Is that happening?
I think it should happen pretty soon. So we have been, during our preparations for this race, we have been working with a couple of other teams, and we actually did demonstrations of two cars at the same track. So I wouldn't be too concerned that it takes a long time to make this happen. Obviously, you know, there's another step going from two cars to more cars. But I'm pretty confident that there will be at least two cars on the same track at the same time racing head to head very soon.
Right. Well, I think what was clear to me, Alex, was I didn't realize that sort of, I guess disparity is maybe the wrong term, but your team, you know, Polymove and your race are made up of PhDs. And as you said, an army of undergrads behind you, while some of the other, there were a couple teams there that were actually just undergrads, right?
Yeah.
Who did a great job, but certainly didn't achieve the same level of complexity that you guys had in your code. And so I think what I observed, probably maybe can you back this up, which is that you got to get everybody to sort of the same milestone of functionality to be able to put everybody on the track at the same time, right?
Yeah, I think that's a crucial next step. But at the same time, I believe, or what we believe in is, we as universities have an interest in actually like boosting the overall development. And mm-hmm. the way how we envision that is we are going to publish a lot of the code we have been using. Mm-hmm. So make that available open source on GitHub or whatever platform we are going to choose. And I believe that this will put also smaller teams in the position to see like, okay, what did those guys do? What mm-hmm. did, I don't know if the other teams are going to do that as well, but I would really encourage them to do so because that will allow us to, you know, focus on the real hard problems instead of replicating again and again the same functionality. And so I believe that we should, like, as a research community, be pretty open about what we achieved and what we probably don't achieve. And then give everybody the chance to improve upon that. And that's probably also putting smaller teams in a position where they can actually compete and probably, you know, they don't have to take the full software code, but probably they mm-hmm. say, okay, we have a level of expertise in a specific area where we want to focus on. And in that other area, which is, you know, necessary to run the race, but it's probably not our core expertise, we are taking mm-hmm. the code from that team from like last year's competition. Mm-hmm. And that still allows us to focus on the problems we find interesting or we are most, we have the most expertise with and still compete in the race. And I think that's going to boost the series as a whole.
And I think that leads to my next question, which is this, when you take events like Robo Race and India Autonomous Challenge, in your view, how does this help accelerate, you know, the arrival of, you know, level 4, level 5 autonomy on the street, as Steve alluded to with some of these commercial applications in the future?
There are two dimensions to this. The first one is obviously all the, let's say, things we can learn from the algorithms. So bringing them up to speed, pushing everything to the limit, running at the vehicle dynamics limit and all these things. Mm-hmm. There are things we can learn from that. You can't take exactly the same algorithm and copy paste it, but the methods you develop, they would for sure benefit what will be done on the streets. I think we have a proven record of showing that by getting a lot of research papers out of these challenges. Mm-hmm. And the other thing, which is probably equally important, if not more important, is the way these competitions allow teams to build talent and also like to get a relationship to the public. So all the students involved here had a tremendous opportunity to actually work in a close to real world environment and learn about all these things prior to actually starting their first job. So if they will be at companies which actually develop these things, they will be in a totally different position.
Yeah.
Because they probably have like 2 years of experience in making this happen here. So, and you know, this working in a team, facing all these challenges you have in the real world is just like complementing the stuff their courses teach them. And I think that we are, that the universities really, let's say, get something out of that, because it's basically teaching the students on how to apply all those concepts they learn to the real world. And that's probably going to help us in the long term.
I got to ask the question that everybody wants to know the answer to here. What happens to the $1 million?
So I think the $1 million really put us in a position where we can, you know, focus on what we want to do and not focus too much on getting funding or sponsorships. So right. It really allows us to boost our program as a whole. So I think it's a great step to make the operations of the team more sustainable in the long term. Instead of like, you know, running from competition to competition and getting sponsors and again and again.
I'm looking at a photo that Mike took of you guys at the finish line holding that check. I thought the fake check would be a little bit bigger for for an amount that size, but that's really cool. I mean, what's next for you and for the other team members? I know Mike's trying to figure out, is there another autonomous race happening maybe in Vegas sometime, what, Mike, in January of 2022? What's next for you guys? When are you going back to Germany? When do you get back into the lab? Just tell us about that.
Yeah, so we are all now going back to Germany in the next couple of days. And I think we are going to take some rest for a couple of weeks to reflect on what has been going on and just recharge our batteries. I think we will definitely will be in for what can happen in the future. Right now, we are working with the organizers to understand of what kind of concepts that could be. Mm-hmm. I don't know when or what exactly this will be at this moment. So, but I think we believe that there will be a lot of value in participating in further races for all the reasons we just discussed. So, I think really the next big thing is to get multiple cars on track. That's something we're all passionate about and which we all want to see. I mean, that's going to be huge.
January seems too close, Mike, now that I'm really thinking about it. I mean, it's not even 3 months away, really, right? Right. To get everybody back there, that just seems not possible.
Right. Well, and so, Alex, obviously, you're on your PhD trek. What's the future hold for you? Are you looking at a career in academia, or are you think potentially you'll end up out in a commercial space pursuing a career working with autonomous vehicles or robotics?
So I've got another half a year to finalize my PhD thesis. And I think that's the time I'm probably going to need after all this intense working on this project. And then let's see, I'll definitely stick around in the autonomous vehicle space. But there's right now there's a good collaboration between academia and commercial companies. So I'm not sure yet where my focus will be, but I would really like to keep pushing on this autonomous racing things, and I just have to figure out what's the best opportunity there.
Are you a racing fan? I mean, you must have a passion for racing in general, right?
Yeah, I think we all do. So yeah, that's true.
Well, Alex, congratulations again to you and the rest of the team. We're rooting for everybody out there on Saturday, and it was super exciting to see this happen and to watch those cars going that fast down the straightaway into the corners at Indy. I know you invoked a lot of excitement for all the spectators that were present, and especially a lot of the kids that were there as well. So, you know, you inspired the next generation as well. So good luck to you and all the rest of the team, whatever the next step holds for you.
Right. Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Steve, for hosting us. And yeah, let's see what the future brings to this autonomous racing series.
That's going to do it, folks, for episode 60 of the Robot Report podcast. Thanks again to Alex Wisniewski for joining us on the program today on short notice. I know he's probably exhausted by all the interview requests that he's gotten the last couple of days. And he's heading back to Germany with him and the team here in a couple of days. So safe travels to those guys. And we'll be watching, Mike. I mean, I know you think maybe something's happening in Vegas sometime soon, but certainly there'll be another autonomous race challenge coming up in the hopefully not too distant future, right?
Yeah, let's keep our eyes peeled for the next one.
Yeah, and we look forward to the video content that you'll be pumping out in the next few days as well. So stay tuned for that. New episodes of the podcast drop each week. You can find us on all the major podcast platforms, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcast. Please subscribe, leave us a rating, give us a review. On behalf of Mike Oitzman and the entire Robot Report crew, I'm Steve Crow. Thanks again, folks, for tuning in. We'll talk to you again next week.